please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. The Supreme Court of Texas is as old as Texas is an independent republic and a state, but this is the first time we have met in Brownsville, Texas, pursuant to a recent constitutional amendment which permits the court to sit outside of the state capitol. Today, we will hear oral arguments in two cases. In the order in which they will be heard, they are as follows: Glenn and Jolynn Bragg versus Edwards Aquifer Authority and others, from Medina County. And then after a brief recess, we'll hear Texas Department of Transportation versus Jesus and Maria Elena Garza, individually and as personal representatives of the estate of Rolando Garza from Hidalgo County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument in these cases. The petitioners may reserve a portion of their 20 minutes for a rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. He will hear the argument, then take a brief break, then hear the second argument, and then that will conclude the oral submissions for the day. The court will return to Austin. We will deliberate on these cases and work on draft opinions, and at some point in the upcoming months, we will decide each of these cases and explain our decision in a written opinion. The court is ready to hear arguments for petitioners in Bragg versus Edward Aquifer Authority.
May it please the court. Mr. Paul Carroll is an argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Rebuttal will be presented by Mr. Carroll.
May it please the court. In 1995, in response to public outcry about the loss of private property rights through environmental regulations, the Texas legislature passed the Private Real Property Rights Preservation Act. The Property Rights Act is the most comprehensive, far-reaching property rights legislation in the nation. The Act has two parts. The first part of the statute...
Mr. Terrell, before you get too much further into your argument, could you resolve a preliminary question that I have for me? The briefs reference the fact that in a case involving a plaintiff called Living Waters in Travis County, that the Travis County Court invalidated the rules that you are challenging in this lawsuit, and that the EAA determined not to appeal that and, in fact, has passed new rules. Is that correct?
That is correct. They're in the process of passing new rules.
Well, since your first challenge in this lawsuit is to claim that those rules are void because of failure to perform a takings impact assessment under the Private Property Rights Act, what is the effect on this court's ability to decide that issue since those rules are invalidated and of no longer in effect?
There are a couple important points here. The first is the rules that we challenged, we were the first case to take their second set of rules. There's three set of rules. We were the first case to take the second set of rules to judgment. And we did, in fact, void those rules because they did not perform a takings impact assessment. And we also were granted a judgment for attorney's fees, which is mandatory under the statute. After that, another group challenged the rules. That's the Living Waters. That's the catfish farmer. The Living Waters folks challenged the rules. That, too, was taken to judgment. That was under a different statute, the Administrative Procedures Act. Our judgment in this case was the first to go to judgment, and since that time, there's an entitlement to attorney's fees in that case. Now, since the EAA has continued in its rulemaking process, it's now on its third set of rules, the EAA has used the Court of Appeals opinion in this case as a justification for not doing a TIA. So once again, they have not done a TIA.
Well, I understand that, but if you're specific, you filed a declaratory judgment action under the Private Property Rights Act provision that allows you to do that. And you were challenging a specific set of rules that are no longer in effect. So how can this court, in fact, then rule on whether those rules are void because of failure to perform a takings impact assessment if the rules are no longer in effect? Is it your attorney's fees claim that keeps the issue alive, and is that all that keeps it alive? Or why isn't the issue mooted in its entirety?
There's 2 points here. First of all, the attorney's fees claim certainly keeps the issue alive. The second is, this is an issue that was solely in the hands of the EAA. They are the ones that took the action.
Well, I understand, but you have to have a live controversy. And if the rules are not in effect, then the controversy can go moot while the case is pending. Why isn't this moot?
Certainly the attorney's fees claim keeps...
Absent the attorney's fees issue, would this case be moot?
No, the case would not be moot.
Why not?
This is the type of case that's capable of repetition yet evading review because, again, we're now on the third set of rules, and it's the EAA's actions that have taken the case out of being a final judgment that's appealed all the way through the system.
Okay, let me ask you a second preliminary question. What is the status of the Bragg's 2 permit applications that are also at issue here?
Okay. The Bragg's, again, on this latest set of rules, they didn't do a TIA, and they made exactly the same recommendations as before, and that is no water for Dehennis, and they partially denied the Home Place Orchard well, giving them 2 acre feet per acre instead of the 4 acre feet that's necessary to irrigate pecan.
So did the invalidation of the rules then, in fact, invalidate the action or proposed action by the EAA on the original applications for a permit? And so they had to go back and do it again?
The EAA... Clearly, any permitting determination, this is not just for the Braggs.
I just need to know the current status of these permits. Are we on to different permit, different actions than originally arose in this lawsuit?
That's correct.
Okay, so as a result of the invalidation, the original determinations by the EAA were wiped out?
Correct.
And they had to start over again?
Correct.
Okay, so we now have 2 additional permit applications. Are they still in the proposed action stage, or has the EAA actually acted and issued its final determination?
The general manager has made a proposed recommendation for both of those permit applications.
So there is no final action?
Correct. And that is, final action is a standard that applies to the APA. It is not a standard that applies to the property rights.
Well, but under the Edwards Aquifer Authority Act, as this court determined in the Barshop decision, that is the applicable statute for judicial review of a permit application decision under the Act.
That statute
sets,
yes.
Okay.
Yes and no.
I know you're proceeding under the Private Property Act, but,
yes, ma'am.
But if they wanted to appeal that final decision by the EAA, they would take it up through the administrative procedure avenue.
Yes. Well, the Property Rights Act provides another way
of addressing those
issues. No, I
understand. I'm just trying to get the procedural situation squared away here. Okay, so we have, and we're still at the proposed action stage on the 2 new applications.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
2 parts to the statute. Takings impact assessment part of the statute protects against takings on the front end, that is before government takes action. Takings impact assessment is a completely new procedure for Texas. Texas has never had it before, and the gist of a TIA is when an agency passes administrative rules, they have to take a hard look at those administrative rules and see whether they're going to have an adverse impact on landowners. In other words, whether they're going to cause a taking. Now, if the TIA comes back and says, yes, if you pass this rule or these sets of rules, you're going to cause a taking, then the agency, at a minimum, needs to look at alternatives to see whether there are ways that the agency can affect the same regulatory goal without causing a taking.
Mr. Terrell, is Texas the only state to have adopted a Real Property Rights Act?
No, there are some other states that have done it, but Texas is clearly the most far-reaching of any statute that's passed by the states. I'd say about a third of the states have passed.
Do any of them require this TIA procedure?
I think that there are other states that have TIA procedures, and I'm not aware of the particulars of those statutes. But
you'd say that Texas's statute is the most comprehensive of all.
It is definitely the most comprehensive of all, and the provision that I would particularly point the court to is the takings cause of action, the statutory
well,
takings.
Well, and that's where I'm heading. Since we do have the most comprehensive statute, apparently, in the United States, isn't it important that when we're writing on a clean slate, we look at the legislative intent in enacting such a sweeping statute?
Very definitely.
And wouldn't you consider the bill's sponsor's statement of intent to be important?
Yes. I think the plain language of the statute is obviously where the court starts, but legislative intent is something that you would look at.
And didn't the bill sponsor state that it was her legislative intent based on the language of the B-11 exemption, and again, here we're on B-11, that it not affect the actions of the Edwards Aquifer? I mean, that is the clear legislative intent.
There are a couple of things that are important about that statement. The first one is, there's no reference to the B-11C exemption. That's something that the EAA says in their brief, but if you look at that two-sentence colloquy that they've quoted, which, by the way, was not relied upon by the San Antonio Court of Appeals, I don't think it stands for that proposition. It doesn't say anything about B-11C.
What do you think that statement was meant to mean if it says it doesn't affect the actions of the
aquifer?
Well,
it's not clear because there's another part of the Property Rights Act that talks about a sole source aquifer and about preventing pollution to a sole source aquifer, and those two legislators were discussing that also. So it's really not clear exactly what she's saying.
Well, how many permits does the EAA review per year?
The initial regular permits that are in the process of being processed by the EAA right now, there's approximately 1,000.
And so under your reading of the statute, you would need 1,000 impact assessments under the Property Rights Act.
No, and this is an absolutely crucial point. When you're passing administrative rules, you do one good TIA when you pass the rules. That way you address programs, you address problems programmatically. Like, for instance, the pecan farmers.
Before you start, I do want to hear your answer to that, but are you abandoning then your attack on the individual permitting?
No.
Well, you can get to that later. But under my question that I just asked you, you are claiming that there would be 1,000 TIAs due.
No, and here's why. If you do a good TIA up front, it's going to address the vast majority of these problems. First of all, you don't have to do a TIA when they're not denying permits. Now, the EAA denied about 30% of the permit applications. Now, if you do one good TIA on the administrative rules, that's going to programmatically address a number of the issues that that are going to come up. For instance, pecan growers need 4 acre-feet of water to grow pecans. So without regard to whether they have the historic use, we know that if they planted their orchard like the Braggs did in 1979, that from 1979 they always needed and had a reasonable investment back to expectation in 4 acre-feet of water. The takings impact assessment should take that reasonable investment back to expectation into account up front. That would address those takings issues from the get-go.
Well, but each person affected by a issuance of a permit would have their own individual issues, would they not? I mean, I don't understand what you're saying here, that there could be one assessment that would affect, what, for 10 years, thousands and thousands of permits? I just don't understand.
And I want to piggyback to that question. The catfish farms, for example, Living Waters, that impacted, 20% of the aquifer, 30% of the aquifer's daily use. You're saying that the one TIA that would affect the Living Water situation would also satisfy your client's concerns?
You have to distinguish between a TIA that's passed for the well permitting rules on the one hand, and those are the well permitting rules that affect everyone that withdraws water from the aquifer, with individual TIAs for permit applications on the other. If a good TIA is done on the administrative well permitting rules up front, that should programmatically address people such as pecan farmers, corn farmers, industrial pumpers, municipal pumpers, address them as classes and look at the problems that are similar to them, to each class, and address them individually. Then if you get past that stage and you find that not all of the takings issues have been addressed, then you would have individual takings impact assessments on those cases where permits have been denied, such as on the Bragg's Dehennis well, where they got no water from the EAA.
But you argue that there should have been a TIA on the one where they didn't deny it, they just didn't grant as much as requested. So your TIA applies not only when they deny a permit, it also applies when they give you something less than you asked for.
In this case, we're not talking about 1 or 2 or 5%. We're talking about a dramatically
50%
less, and it's impossible to grow pecans on 2 acre feet of water, and that is an undisputed fact in this case.
Let me ask you about this main TIA you're talking about. Isn't the authority supposed to, you know, if you take out 5 acre feet here, and it's more than what the legislature permits to be taken, then the authority has to take that 5 from somebody else, don't they? I mean, it's not like everybody gets 5. It's like if you give more than what the legislature says here, you got to take it from somebody's application here. I think you make a reference. You could, maybe somebody made a reference. You can buy that authority from somebody else. But it's not like you could determine that all pecan growers get 4, however much it is, acre feet of water as a general permit without some determination that there's somebody else out there who isn't going to get as much as they want, don't you?
There's two answers to that question. First, with regard to takings impact assessments, if you found, for instance, that pecan growers need 4 acre feet of water, that does not tell the EAA that they have to give pecan growers 4 acre feet of water. What it tells them is, if you don't give them 4 acre feet of water, it's going to cause a taking. It's going to adversely affect their operations. So that's the first answer. The second answer is, on the amount of water that's available, the legislature set a floor at 450,000 acre-feet and then gave the EAA discretion to raise that amount if they want to. And that is the EAA's call. They say that they have to consult with state agencies and consult with federal agencies, but that's ultimately the EAA's decision.
But wouldn't that be temporary permits that's not done? The additional increment above the 450,000 is not a permanent permit like these are. It would be an interruptible permit. It's a different process.
That's correct. And for agricultural users, that's essentially fatal, because if you can't grow your crop on a regular basis.
But hadn't the legislature made that call? That it's incremental and it's subject to interruption. It's not a permanent, would not be a permanent grant of rights to pump above 450,000.
No, because the EAA gave the state gave the EAA the discretion to raise the amount of
water.
But
if they do that, that amount, that increment is subject to interruption. It's not a permanent permit, and the EAA would have to periodically review that to determine whether that extra amount, incremental amount, could be pumped or not.
They would have to review that.
So it's not a permanent initial grant as we're talking about in these cases.
The initial regular permits have a different status than the temporary permits.
Mr. Terrell, before you sit down, let me ask you another question about interpreting the statute. I understand that under 2207.003B, that which is the exclusionary provisions in the Property Rights Act, that you take the position that rulemaking is not an action. But assume with me for purposes of this question that rulemaking is an action under subpart 4, where there is an exclusion for the action of a political subdivision that is reasonably taken to fulfill an obligation mandated by state law. Can you tell me, with respect to these rules that you are challenging, as compared to the statute, in what ways the substantive guidelines provided in the statute are at variance from the rules that you are challenging here?
Okay.
Your opponent takes the position that they match, that what the EAA has promulgated in substance is exactly what the legislature said in the statute. And I'm unable to locate in your brief any place where you take argument with that. Can you tell me specifically where the rules that you challenge vary what the legislature has said the EAA must do in permitting and controlling the taking of water from the aquifer?
Yes. I want to start by emphasizing that of the 4 exceptions that are claimed by the EAA, including B4, not one of them mentions rules or rulemaking. And there are 3 exceptions to the Act.
I want you to assume with me that rulemaking is something that is an action for purposes of the exclusion. I understand you don't agree with that.
Okay.
I just want to know in what way there is a variance between the substance of the rules that you challenge and the specific provisions of the statute as enacted by the legislature.
Okay. 2 points here. First, the EAA takes the position that each rule that we challenge has to be match up directly with the Dehennis permits or Dehennis and Home Place orchards, and that they are mandated by state law, and that's not the case. Let's take Dehennis for instance. They say that they are mandated to give them 4 acre feet, excuse me, zero on Dehennis and 2 acre feet on the Home Place. In Barshop, this court held that the dates where it says that you must file a DHU is mandatory, not directory. They claim that the provision in the Edwards Aquifer Act says that you, they say they are mandated to deny that. The language in that provision, and I believe it's 114E, but I'm not positive about that, and I'll get that for the court if you want me to. It says may not. It does not say shall not. It says may not. The difference between may and shall shows that they have discretion to act there. And then the other thing that I would point to is that they have grandfathered other wells.
I'm not talking about any actions that they've taken pursuant to the rules. I want you to put the rules right here and the statute right here and tell me in what way the rules promulgated by the EAA in substance are different from what the legislature promulgated as specific requirements in the statute.
Okay.
You see what I mean? Maybe I haven't
yes.
said it.
Yes.
No,
I think I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
One of the key things that the EAA has done is that they have provided a number of guaranteed minimums to other irrigators. And so this is a substantial difference between the statute on the one hand and the rules on the other.
Okay, what rule are you looking at? Can you quote me the rule
off
number?
The top of my there it's in the definition sections, and off the top of my head there is an above 10-year pumper rule that is commonly referred to as the San Antonio Water Systems rule, the SAWS rule, that allows over 10-year pumpers to drop out low use years. The effect of that is it raises their average up. Another rule that varies from the statute, and that gives them more water. And because we're talking about who gets how much water,
you're not challenging that rule in this case, though.
Yes, we are, because if that gives them more water, then because we're talking about an amount where you're allocating a set amount between different users, that definitely affects the allocation. There's other rules to that effect.
That rule is at variance with the language of the statute.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
The second rule.
What else?
The second rule is the under 3-year pumper rule, and that's commonly referred to as the catfish farmer rule. That rule, the EAA specifically is, and it's been challenged, and the EAA says, well, we have broad discretion to enact this rule. The EAA says, well, we have broad discretion to prevent a regulatory taking. And they say that in the preamble to their rules. And so those are two examples. There are others as well, but I wanted to give the court at least two examples.
Thank you.
Counsel, before you sit down, also, can you explain why the statute itself, by its own terms, doesn't exempt the EAA from having to make these rules for the particular type of regulation they're undertaking here, most particularly under 2007.003B11C, action taken by a subdivision to prevent waste or protect rights of owners of interest in groundwater, but also under the broader 003A4, enforcing government action by use of permitting.
Okay, and I think this is absolutely critical. Property Rights Act applies to groundwater, protects groundwater rights, and it applies to rulemaking. At that point, it's the EAA's burden to prove that one of these exemptions applies. And when you look at the 14 exemptions in the Act, those 14 exemptions, there's only three instances where rulemaking is exempt. The four exemptions that the EAA has relied on, B4, B6, B11C, and B13, not one of them mentions rulemaking. Now, what I particularly want to hone in on is the B14 exemption, where the legislature said that an action or rulemaking is exempt. Now, they could have done exactly the same thing in any of those other four exemptions. Like, for instance, they could have said an action or rulemaking of a political subdivision that's reasonably taken to fulfill an obligation mandated by state law, but they didn't do that. They said an action. And we believe that action means a narrow, fact-specific situation, and it does not include rulemaking. And the reason for that is the whole purpose of TIAs is to address administrative rulemaking. And if you read those exemptions that broadly, it floods the Act.
Well, but counsel, you kind of catch yourself coming and going on that, because the word action is used for purposes of applying the act as well, both in subpart A of that provision of the statute and also in what is it, in the provision of the statute that actually sets out the requirement of a TIA being done. It refers to an action. And clearly in the applicability provisions, without using the word rulemaking in some instances, action, you're saying we should interpret action. In 2007.043, I believe, there's no mention of rulemaking there. And yet you're saying that we need to interpret action there to mean rulemaking, and we need to do it with respect to Part A of 2007.003, but when it comes to the exclusion, when we see the word action, we are not to do that. So I kind of hear you coming and going in terms of hitting yourself.
That's not what we're saying. Yourself. That's what they're saying that we're saying.
Well, if your brief specifically says that under 2007.003 and 043 that action means rulemaking.
No, it says, and this is absolutely critical to interpret this statute, 003A says that it applies to the following governmental actions. Mm-hmm. In our view, governmental actions is the broad spectrum of actions that are covered by the Act. Within that broad spectrum, there are a number of different things that fit into that. Rulemaking, forfeitures, seizures, things of that nature. Then when you go to the exemptions, it doesn't say governmental action. It says action. And then it follows the word action.
It starts with B. This chapter does not apply to the following governmental actions. It uses the exact same words.
But then when it gets to the actual meat of the statute, the specific ones that are exempted, it says an action. And then it follows it with very narrow words.
But
like, for instance, it says...
Way, that's the same way that A is drafted. The same way that A is drafted. It just uses A. The setup for A and B are exactly the same.
It's the subparts under B that then say action, and then it uses words that are very fact-specific. Like, for instance, B6, which they're claiming says that the governmental entity proves that a condition of property use is a nuisance. That's not a rule. You know, they're proving a nuisance. That's not a rulemaking function. They're saying that if there's leaking hazardous waste over the aquifer that's a nuisance, you can go out and you can address that problem without having to do a TIA. That'd be ludicrous. Rulemaking, on the other hand, is extremely different. It's a quasi-legislative function where they're making programmatic rules that affect thousands, in this case, millions of people. There's a huge distinction between these narrow, fact-based exemptions and rulemaking, on the other hand, which is a legislative function. There's other ones that stand for the same proposition. 13, for instance, real and substantial threat, it exempts an action that's a real and substantial threat to public health and safety, is designed to significantly advance the health and safety purpose, and does not impose a greater burden than is necessary to achieve the health and safety purpose. That's a narrow exemption. It's a fact question. You can't say that something as broad as rulemaking can be shoehorned into that exemption, because if it does, then the Act, particularly the takings impact assessment part of the Act, means nothing, because everything will be exempt.
But you could certainly shoehorn protecting waste or property rights, interest in groundwater, under rulemaking. I mean, there could certainly be a rule that would cover B11C.
Your Honor, that is not our reading of the statute, and there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, again, we don't believe that the statute applies exempt rulemaking unless the legislature uses that word, which they've done in three very narrow circumstances. Second, if you look at preventing waste, that is a narrow, specific, fact-intensive inquiry that, in fact, is defined by the Edwards Aquifer Act, and there's no question about, in the Bragg's instance, there wasn't any waste involved.
Well, counsel, now, you don't really address the definition of waste in other contexts. If everybody is doing exactly what the Bragg's doing, which is using good conservation techniques, but nevertheless the total demand for water exceeds the amount that can be pumped out of the aquifer, mm-hmm. isn't that by definition waste?
It is by definition waste, and that definition is circular. It creates this... They set a rule that says that this is waste, and then if you...
But under your analysis, if you could go into court and prove that I'm a conservative user of water, I'm a farmer, I don't exceed my limits, I do everything according to all the highest agricultural standards, but there are 1,000 farmers who can prove exactly that, and the total demand for water far exceeds a 450,000 level. Under your interpretation, the EA is powerless to do anything about it.
No. And this is, again, this is what's critical about takings impact assessments. This is not about telling the EAA how they regulate the aquifer. That is, that's their, they
but
have been given that authority.
But under your definition of waste, it is.
This is about whether they're exempt from the Property Rights Act, whether they have to take property rights into consideration.
I'm just asking what your definition of waste means. And my understanding is that if the total demand exceeds the supply, that just like the Railroad Commission has to deal with oil and gas issues, they have to promulgate rules to decide how to prevent, quote, waste, meaning how to deal with the excess demand over supply.
As the legislature used waste in this statute, it is not a broad term. It is designed.
Where do we find the basis for that? Where do we find the definition of waste as not a broad term?
It has to do with the fact that, first of all, it's talking about an action. It's not using the rulemaking term. That's the first thing. The second thing is, when you look at the nature of these exemptions, they tend to be very narrow, fact-specific, and addressing specific circumstances. I'll give you an example of what I think would be addressed by that. If someone had their well open, Edwards well open, and they were flowing water off of their irrigation fields into the ditch and clearly wasting water, I think that would be addressed by the statute. That would be something that would fall within that exemption. You wouldn't have to do a TIA, for instance, to go out and shut that well off. Again, that would be folly.
Well, does the Railroad Commission have to do a TIA before it promulgates rules in the oil and gas industry to prevent waste and protect relative rights?
Your Honor, I have not looked into that question.
Isn't waste used the same in both Section 9 and Section 11, don't you think?
Groundwater and oil, there's some overlap between the two. They're related concepts, but as to whether those mean the same thing, I know that there's an additional phrase in there. They say prevent waste of oil and gas, protect correlative rights, or prevent pollution. So there's certainly a difference between the two phrases that they're using there. But again, I think the exemptions to the Act are narrow and that there's not exemptions for programmatic rule.
So that's my question. Does the Railroad Commission have to do a TIA before it promulgates statewide rules?
Because that particular exemption does not say an action or rulemaking as, say, B-14 does, then that is something that the Railroad Commission would have to do a takings impact assessment for.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Please, the court. Mr. Mike Hatchell will present argument to the respondents.
Mr. Hatchell, could you first address the question of whether this case is moot,
well,
or maybe we should say not right?
I was going to do that, Your Honor. Prior to Justice Hankinson's very thoughtful questions, I was going to open this argument in a different way and conclude my argument with a respectful request that the court consider an improvident grant in this case. It is true, as counsel has been very candid in telling you, that what he is asking the court to do through this action is to apply the Private Property Act to invalidate rules that have already been invalidated. This is not a case of last impression. It's a case of no impression. And counsel, I think, has also been candid in telling the court that the Bragg's applications have now been reprocessed under new rules, and they are pending approval under new rules. And I do not candidly think that the court has a case or controversy before it at the present time. I will also be candid in telling the court that the parties did not emphasize this, particularly below, because they're both desirous of an interpretation of the Act.
Was there a takings impact statement with respect to the new rules?
None of this is in your record, Your Honor, and I will... The answer is no, because unequivocal position of the authority is that it's not required.
But I'm a little bit confused. I thought counsel a while ago said that there were no new rules pending, that they had been recommended but not actually promulgated, and I hear you say...
I was confused by that as well, Your Honor, and we have a full complement of new rules that are in effect and are being used. Now, those rules may also be... And I candidly don't know the answer to this question. They may also be under continuous consideration for revision, but The Braggs are subject to a new complement of rules, which are final and effective as to them.
Do they differ substantively on how they treat?
Well, they differ, again, and this is not in the record, Your Honor, and perhaps if the court requests, we could supply those to the court. But they differ. When you say substantively, I suppose the answer to that question is not in great substance. They flesh out some of the more discretionary aspects, but insofar as basic structure is concerned, they are relatively the same. And candidly, the action in regard to the Braggs has been the same under the new rules, although insofar as the Braggs are concerned, the action will always be the same because they can never get more or less than they got.
Mr. Hatchell, moving to the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, an argument could be made that the Court of Appeals opinion is written very broadly or applies the act in a very broad interpretation that essentially eviscerates the Private Property Act if the CA's opinion stands. And so as written, it's got to be fixed. Now, take that as the premise. Then what do you say is the strongest argument, the argument that made the CA's opinion correct, and is the argument that the Edward Aquifer Authority relies on?
Your Honor, I'm going to answer that in two parts, and it's a very good question. But let me say that first, I do not agree with the fundamental underlying premise, except to the extent you can make an argument. And this, I don't think you can make a good argument in interpreting the Court of Appeals opinion, and I think that's one of the problems in this case. Very skillfully, opposing counsel has attempted to characterize the opinion of the Court of Appeals in the way that you have just described. I would ask the court to look at Justice Duncan's opinion and also Justice O'Connor's opinion in the McMillan case, and I think that you will see that what Justice Duncan does in this case is finds the mandate at a much higher level in the statute, and in fact finds it in the Constitution. She does not hold at the end of the day that just the words shall make rules are the state mandate. I think what she has said is that shall make rules is the reasonableness factor. But if you will look at the top of, well, I don't know that I have a page number here, but she actually lists two sections of the Edwards Aquifer Act. One which, and particularly the one which says that the authority shall ensure compliance with permitting requirements and shall regulate permits as also being a mandate. But also throughout the opinion, she traces the mandate from the Constitution. She traces the mandate from the Constitution into the preamble and throughout the various provisions of the statute, and I think that is where the opinion finds the mandate. Now, let me assume, however, that you read the Court of Appeals opinion. Well, and let me finish this statement by saying, if you construe, as I do, that the opinion speaks of a broad mandate, you have very little problem with the B4 exception because insofar as it being an all-encompassing exclusion because, first of all, it applies only to political subdivisions and not agencies. So this list of horribles at the end of the brief of opposing counsel listing all the agencies who supposedly will be exempt from this act simply does not apply. But secondly, as I say, I think the proper interpretation of the B4 exception is, as I think Justice Duncan has done, is to look to the broad mandate from the Constitution to the preamble and to the powers clause of the statute, and to say that the shall make rules is what makes it reasonable. How can it be unreasonable for the authority to pass rules when they are mandated to pass rules in accordance with the other mandates of the statute?
But if that's the case, what does the Property Act do? Nothing.
Oh, no, Your Honor, I don't agree with that. I mean, we're talking here about simply whether the Edwards Aquifer Authority is subject to one of the exclusions in the case.
But no agency can make rules unless it's authorized to do so.
Correct. That is correct. But agencies are not exempted agencies are not exempted. Only political subdivisions are exempted insofar as state action is concerned. And I'm not sure that I have counted how many of those many, many statutes that are listed in the back of the brief apply to agencies. I think is it all but three of those. You can't really answer that scope question until you just look at all of the political subdivision statutes. But this is not, the Chicken Little argument just simply doesn't work in this case. But I do have an answer, Justice Enoch, for the construction that your hypothetical gives to Justice Duncan's opinion. First of all, it would seem to me that it would be useless to require a takings impact statement in defense of her opinion just based on rules for promulgating rules that you're mandated to comply with. What is the takings impact statement going to tell you about those rules? You've got to do them, and the statute has certain statutory minimums that have to be in there, so I think that it would be useless.
In that regard, let me ask you quickly, what about the so-called catfish exemption? Your position, as I take it, is essentially that everything that has been done under these rules is mandated by the statute, and the other side says no, there's all this leeway. Look, for example,
which is not to say, Your Honor, that the authority is without discretion to flesh out through rules the broad mandate of the statutes. And in regard to the catfish exemptions and other exemptions, I think what is happening there, although I'm not candidly an authority on every one of those exemptions, I think what's happening there is they're finding that when you do the proportional reduction, you can put some users almost back to zero. And I think it's the clear mandate of the Act that historical users should have some rights. So what I think is happening in these examples that counsel mentions is that they're really promoting the basic overall policy of the Act to protect the rights of historical users.
But isn't that the Bragg's argument in this case, that they're an historical user and you're essentially putting them back to zero?
Your Honor, I don't see how they can be a historical user because they simply don't qualify. But that, yes, to answer your question, that is their argument.
At least as to the first well.
No, as to the second well. They are a historical user as to the first well.
As to the first well, they're saying we're an historical user and you're putting us back to zero.
Well, of course, the historical user doesn't, you don't get just any amount that you want to pump as a historical user. Of course, the statute itself sets out the way historical
users. That's
user,
my question. Yeah. Is the catfish exemption a departure from the statute or not?
No, again, I think that it is certainly, no, it has got to be consistent with the notion that historical users at least gain some rights. For example, the best is, let's take irrigators, which is the most specific example in the statute. If they were bombed back to zero or to an unacceptable amount through the proportional reduction, they nevertheless get the irrigator minimum. And I think that the broad mandate of the Act gives the authority the right to also identify other specific categories that are in need of aid in relation to that broad
mandate. Can you give me the section of the Act that says that you're not bound by the proportional reduction section, that you've got leeway to depart from the proportional reduction section?
Well, indeed, we are bound by that, but I do think that the general overall provisions of the Act do provide for calculations and studies in which we can adjust. And it seems to me like what we're talking about is simply nothing more than a specific adjustment which falls within the broad powers to make adjustments.
Well, that's my question. Where's the statutory authority for these calculations and adjustments?
Well, the statutory authority would be in the power given to them to manage, well, number one, to manage the mandate under the Act. I believe that's 1.08. And the other is to manage through a permitting system. And I think coming with that is discretion on behalf of the authority to also ensure within the spirit and letter of the specific criteria in the Act to have some leeway to grant those things that they have done. Because
one of the amicus brief mentioned, just so I'm trying to understand how the statute works, mentioned that with respect to the Bragg's well, that what they were allowed to take water from because of their historical use. That in fact they benefited from the regulations because they had to come up to the, they were able to come up to the minimum, which is more than what their historical use showed. So in fact, as a result of the application of the regs to them, that they got more benefit than they otherwise would have. Is that, is that accurate?
Your Honor, they will probably dispute this,
right.
but my reading of what they've done is that they have essentially gotten double their historical use. Where the problem comes in is for the last year, they put down a very large amount.
That was outside the historical use period.
Well, no, it wasn't outside the historical use period, but they put down a very large amount for a half a year. Because and so the authority had to factor that out because the statutory minimums are only calculated insofar as what their base rate would be on a full year. So what happened was, I think that they were fairly consistent if their use during the historical period, except for this one half year. And I think that that was around 45 acre feet. And then what happened is when they were proportionally reduced, it came down below their historical use. So as irrigators, they got bumped up to 112 or so, which was roughly double what we think their historical use was. And I'm sorry for making such a long answer.
That's fine. Mr. Hanschel, let me ask you real quickly. We keep focusing on the TIA and the burden that would be. Opposing counsel seems to say that's really not that big a deal. It wouldn't be that many impact statements. But we're also talking about takings claims, aren't we? And would you please address
indeed,
what
the
impact
Indeed, we are, Your Honor, and that was going to be the other ending that I would have made to this argument is that's what we're really fighting about here, and nobody, I think, misunderstands that what is, and the Braggs are perfectly legitimate in what they're doing. They're challenging and trying to get a construction of these exemptions through the TIA side of the Act. But those exemptions apply just as well to the takings side of the Act. Well, you heard the number of exemptions, I mean, number of permits that we process, which they contend will all be subject to TIA. It's 1,000 here. The subsidence district has 5,000 of these pending at the present time. And what happens is if a takings impact assessment has to be done is we're put to the Hobson's choice. If adverse findings are made insofar as the 25% property reduction, to either invalidating, let's in this instance, we would have to invalidate our rules, even though we're mandated to pass rules, or two, we have to essentially pay tribute, and I don't mean that unkindly, for the right to do what the statute commands and conserve. And I just think that that's a very intolerable situation, and I think that is precisely why in the 11C exclusion for conservation and waste, that the legislature was specifically understood, as Representative Combs said, that this is just not going to apply to the Edwards Aquifer Act because we can't function under that, and I would submit to the court that the amicus briefs, particularly the subsidence district, will demonstrate they can't function either.
Let me ask you one question on that, and you mentioned the exchange with Representative Combs in the brief, and there are other parts of the testimony, and I just have a broad question about legislative intent.
Mm-hmm.
How much should we rely on exchanges between particular legislators or even statements in a summary of the bill that don't find their way into the actual legislation? I mean, what is our role when we interpret a statute is what I'm asking. Should we look at the rule, I mean, the words themselves, interpret those, or should we look back at exchanges like that?
Although I think Your Honor and I might differ as to whether or not those actual words got into the statute, because I read the 11 exemption as being those exact words. But I did a search recently in conjunction with a talk that I did and determined that this court has decided at least 55 cases since January 1 of 1999 on statutory construction. And far be it for me to say that all of those statements are exactly in line with one another, but I think I generally get the sense, Your Honor, that this court is now determined to go to the words first. And Representative Combs' statements, if you do not find there to be any ambiguity in these in the language, and I can't frankly tell whether or not they're alleging ambiguity or not, and I think you go straight to the language. That's the way I read most of the cases that the court has decided. Now, you do get into other cases, Eric, which talk about some of the background facts, and certainly background facts are very important. But I think the strictest line of authority that I find out of this court is you go to the language first. And legislative history doesn't mean anything until there is at least some form of ambiguity. The Code Construction Act, of course, is different, and it allows you somewhat broader discretion in that regard. And the court might well move to a position where the elements of the Code Construction Act are considered.
Mr. Hatchell, if you begin with the premise that prior to the Edwards-Oxford Act that came into existence, I assume the parties could pump whatever they wanted to out of the Edwards-Oxford.
Absolutely. And that's the problem.
And so the Act now changes the a person's right to pump out of the Edwards-Oxford. I'm a little bit unclear about what the Edwards-Oxford's position about what it's mandated to do is. If citizens could not pump all they wanted to out of Edwards-Oxford, and the Oxford comes into existence and sets a different amount, mm-hmm. and the legislature says, well, everybody can pump this amount of water, and so Edwards-Oxford permits everybody to pump that amount of water. I could understand that the permitting process is co-equal with the mandate from the legislature. But if they could pump anything they wanted to, and the aquifer authority comes in, and now the legislature says, well, this is the minimum they can be permitted to pump, but the authority could offer a greater amount to be pumped. Why isn't the authority's refusal to allow a greater amount to be pumped not mandated by the legislature? I may not be articulating very
well.
This is the unstated disagreement between the parties. Wright seemed to argue we could have pumped all we wanted to, and their failure to allow us to do that is what needs the impact statement. And it seems to me your argument that you're mandated to do this comes from the premise, forget about the fact they could have always pumped. The legislature now says they can pump this amount, and since we're allowing them to pump that amount, that's the mandate we have. We don't need to do the TIA. What happens if we decide that if you refuse to not allow them to pump all they want to, that's when the TIA applies?
Then I think you've undermined the statutory regulatory scheme, because if everybody gets an exemption and gets whatever they want, why regulate at all?
Well, they don't, but the statute seems to imply that if they now no longer do, there's got to be this impact statement.
I suppose, Your Honor, in a perfectly free world, if I owned a lot that had an abandoned building on it, and I wanted to clear that lot, I could either dynamite it or blow it down. But benefits to society in general would say that that's dangerous, and it's also dangerous to me. So I think that what we're really talking about here is the perhaps revisiting the issue that was visited in the Barshop opinion, in which the Edwards Aquifer Authority Act withstood every constitutional challenge that could be, that more than I could think of. And one of the telling things in there is that this is an act which is aimed at public health, welfare, and safety, among other things. I think what we have here is simply a legislative choice that, unfortunately, some individual rights have to give sway to a greater right in the public at large, and that's indeed is in the preamble.
Okay, let me. So your position then would be that we start our evaluation of whether or not a TIA applies, we start with a presumption that the use of water is already regulated.
Correct.
And the TIA is not needed so long as you permit what the legislature specifically authorized as the minimum. Because you've authorized the minimum use out of the home place, there's no TIA required. And because you've refused to authorize a new well to be drilled in Tehanus, that's the minimum that the legislature set. Therefore, no TIA is needed for that. And that's the line.
I don't look at it as a look at it on a specific case-by-case basis. I mean, I think that these exemptions apply across the board. Your Honor, one provision of the statute that I think gets a lot to your question that hasn't been mentioned very much is in the general powers provision, which says that this article prevails over any provision of general law that is in conflict or inconsistent with this article regarding the area of the authority's jurisdiction. And I think what you're saying here is essentially that there is a head-on collision between the Property Rights Act and the Edwards Aquifer Act, and I don't see that. I think the legislature has said there is no collision, that because of the necessity that we preserve water based upon historical problems with drought, this is a crying public need that we regulate and that individual rights are going to have to give sway. And that if there's a general law like the Private Property Rights Act that seems to, in a general way, impinge upon that, the Edwards Aquifer Act is the one that you look to.
But we did say in Barsham that the takings issue remains. We saw the truck coming.
Absolutely.
We're going to get out of the way this time. But
And I hope I can get out of the way before I have to answer that question, Your Honor, because that is another hour's worth of argument, I think.
My colleagues won't let me take that long. But let me ask you, though, to clarify what was said earlier, as you view the Bragg's request, it can't be granted under the regime that the legislature has set up.
That is correct. They can never get more, nor can they get less.
And so they will have recourse to this requirement, the argument under the property rights statute that the takings assessment is required under these circumstances.
Right.
And to that extent, at least, this dispute hasn't gone away and isn't going to go away until it gets resolved.
Correct. One thing, Your Honor, I think should be understood, and I think it is understood by the court, that the Braggs are not without water rights. The Act very prudently provides for commerce in water rights, and the Braggs can buy water rights.
But the real issue on takings here is, do they have to proceed under the common law development of the of our constitutional takings provision, or are they entitled to the much more lenient a takings test under the statute?
That is an issue, Your Honor, and I would point out that appropriately, I think the focus of that dispute is not on the authority. It's the Act itself, if the court were to so say, the Edwards Aquifer Act itself, and the state, I think, is the one doing the taking in this case. And I think prudentially, you always want to focus the constitutional takings claims on the person that's doing the taking. We are doing nothing as a political subdivision.
My point is, if we hold that no TIA is required, we're essentially holding that they don't get the lenient taking standard of the Act either.
That is correct. Yes.
Taking you back to what you planned on concluding with, let me take you back to the mootness question. What is the effect of the Bragg's claim for attorney's fees on whether or not this case is now moot?
That's an interesting question because it sort of bundles up appellate procedure in addition to, but I would take the position that that if mootness occurs during the process of a case, that the ancillary rights and remedies are void as a matter of law. I can't cite any authority to that effect, Your Honor, but it seems to me that that is consistent with the doctrine of mootness, because if there is no case or controversy, it seems to me almost the same result as a voluntary dismissal.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Terrell, let's continue the assumption that the B4 language is overbroad. I don't think I clearly understand why the B11C exclusion does not apply.
With respect to our challenge to the EAA's well permitting rules, unless an exemption says that it applies to rulemaking, it doesn't apply to rulemaking. There are very narrow instances where the legislature has exempted rulemaking, and B4, B6, B11C, and B13 are not any of those instances.
Notwithstanding the general language that precedes all that. That's your contention.
What general language are you talking about, sir?
Where it discusses the... the governmental actions. And I guess I'm curious on that point. If rulemaking is not going to be considered a governmental action, what actions would the authority be doing?
Now, again, there's a distinction between governmental action, which is this broad spectrum of actions, governmental actions that are covered by the Act, which includes rulemaking, and then the exemptions where they use the word action instead of governmental action and then follow it with narrow fact-specific words like preventing a nuisance or addressing threats to health and safety, that sort of thing. If you give, part of this is just how do you look at a remedial statute like the Property Rights Act? Property Rights Act, I think this is probably perfectly obvious, but I need to state it here. It's designed to protect landowners, not the governmental entities. And so to the extent that there are any close calls in the statute, they need to be calls in favor of those who are being protected by the statute, the landowners. And
well, would you in that regard, something that Mr. Hatchell raised was his citation to the general powers provision of the Edwards Aquifer Act that this statute being more specific is going to control over more general statutes.
Okay,
that seems to fit in with what you're talking about. Would you mind addressing that argument?
I think what the legislature is talking about there is Chapter 36 of the Water Code is the general provision that addresses groundwater districts. The EAA Act is different in many particulars from general groundwater district authority under Chapter 36. I think that that's what they're talking about there. They're talking about the difference between the Edwards Aquifer Act on the one hand and general law powers under Chapter 36 of the Water Code as regards groundwater districts generally. And the EAA is very definitely different than most.
As we classically talk about general provisions of statutes and specific provisions, which we talk about a lot, you would agree that the Private Property Act in and of itself is a more general statute than the Edwards Aquifer Act and that it is more specific. Because your position is that the Private Property Act has very, very broad application, that it just covers the waterfront across the state. So it's more general, isn't it, than the Edwards Aquifer Act, which is very specific in terms of regulation. No, I understand, but classically we talk about general statutes and specific statutes. Those are legal terms.
Yes, and I just
and it
don't
is
think...
A, your position is that Private Property Rights Act is of general application, isn't it?
It is certainly a statute of general application.
And the Edwards Aquifer Act is one of specific application.
Well, it applies to the Edwards, but
and
I think that
that's a specific application, correct?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
The EAA has cited the McMillan case, and I want to focus on McMillan for just a minute here. First of all, McMillan is a statutory takings case. It's not a TIA case, and so in that sense, it's distinguishable. But I want to put that aside because McMillan is wrongly decided, and I think it's important for this court to look at McMillan because it is a very superficial and I think essentially dangerous opinion to the Property Rights Act because it reads the mandated by state law exemption to mean authorized by state law. They go through and they look at whether that governmental entity has authority under state law to do what it did, and then they take that to mean mandated by state law. And so that would mean only an ultra vires act would be outside of what they're looking at there. And that's an absurd construction of the statute. Mandated by state law has to be more specific than that. It's the type of action for which a mandamus would lie. At least that's our conception of the statute.
Mr. Hatchell says that if you're right on the statutory arguments, EAA and subsidence districts really can't make it, can't continue doing what they're doing. What's your response to that?
Several responses. First of all, they claim that we're making a Chicken Little argument. That's their Chicken Little argument.
Well, they either got to both make it or both give up.
Right. And I know we're not giving up.
All right, so
here we are. Takings impact assessment, the whole purpose of that is, they say that this is really about a takings claim. It's not. The purpose of this is, if you can give the Braggs water, then it satisfies their needs. And we're not talking about a lot
You're
of water.
You're waiving your, any future takings claim?
Pardon me?
You're waiving any future
claim? No. I think it depends on what the EAA does when they do a takings impact assessment and gives the pecan growers some more water. But to be serious about this, this isn't about takings. If you do a good TIA up front when you pass your permitting rules, you can address, I'm not saying you can address all the problems. You can certainly address a lot of them, though.
How would get more water under the statutory mandates? I mean, it may be that the catfish exemption is unlawful because it violates the statute, but we shouldn't decide this case based on a catfish exemption, should we? I mean, how do you get around the mandates in the statute that says you proportionately reduce unless you're an irrigator, and well, then you get a minimum?
Here's what they did. That you do have to proportionately reduce. And by the way, the home place well did get proportionately reduced. We just fundamentally disagree on that, and I think the record speaks for itself. But you proportionately reduce until you get to a minimum. There's two minimums in the statute. There's 2 acre feet for irrigators. That's a minimum. It's not a maximum. It's a minimum. And then there's also a three-year historic pumper rule. What the EAA did is they passed additional rules to protect some other folks. Like, for instance, they passed the Saws rule to protect
that
them.
That may not be statutorily permitted, but do we base our decision on what the statute say based on perhaps unlawful action by the EAA?
I'm not saying that what the EAA did was unlawful. What I'm saying is they exercised their discretion in those instances, which they claim that they have, to protect certain classes of irrigators. If they're taking property rights into account for those folks, they ought to do it across the board. Like they specifically say on the catfish farmer rule that they're passing that rule to protect against a regulatory taking. If they're taking property rights into account
Where
for certain...
Where do they have statutory authority to do that is my question. Do they have the statutory authority to do that or not?
Here's what the EAA says. They say, we are given broad, general authority.
What does the statute say? Where do they have the statutory authority to vary from the proportionate reduction?
They're not varying from the proportionate reduction. They're still saying that they proportionately reduce. It's just that everybody eventually hits a minimum. And what they did is they, by rule, gave certain classes of irrigators minimums so that they wouldn't get proportionately reduced any further.
Where do they have the statutory authority to give minimums based on other than historical usage or the irrigator exemption?
When they have been challenged on that, what they do is they point to the general provisions in the Edwards Aquifer Act that say, essentially, you have the authority to come up with a permitting system to regulate the aquifer. I don't have the site off the top of my head.
But part of your argument is you're asking us to assume that that's legal, number one, that the statute allows them to do that, and that therefore they've got all this discretion, which we may or may not agree with. But doesn't your argument under the Act that it's not mandated hinge on whether they have that discretion or not?
I think they do have that. I think that they have discretion to regulate the aquifer. The whole purpose of coming up with something like the Edwards Aquifer Act is the legislature doesn't decide the fine details. They give the authority to a political subdivision, the EAA, to decide who gets what. There's always inherent authority in rulemaking. Within certain parameters.
Okay. Ms. Terrell, I understand the argument. In my mind, it seems to me I understand the argument to be this. The Edwards Aquifer says they don't have to do a TIA because they gave you the minimum that's authorized by the legislature. It seems to me your argument is no, because they didn't give us what we requested, they have to do the TIA. And your response is, since that's just a minimum, that means there's this discretion out here, and because they didn't exercise that discretion in our favor, they have to do TIA. Am I reading you correctly? The reason you're entitled to TIA is because they didn't grant you more than what the legislative minimum gives you.
Yes and no. There's two parts to this, and it's important to distinguish between the two. When the Braggs challenged the rules as opposed to the permit determinations, All the Braggs have to show is that they are property owners that are affected by those rules. They don't have to go in and say, well, this rule does this and this rule does that to us.
But if they give all pecan growers the minimum, if they give pecan growers, your argument is that they gave different industries something other than the minimum, isn't it?
Yeah, they took property rights into account for them,
so
but
your argument
not everyone.
Still is, you know, your argument still is that the reason the TIA is due is because they didn't exercise that discretion in your favor. They just gave you the minimum. And their argument is we don't have to do the TIA.
It's actually different than that. It's that they didn't look at it at all. The Property Rights Act doesn't tell you what rules you have to pass, but it says you do have to take property rights for everyone into account, and they did not do that.
Can we look at that in terms of the well that did not have historical use, and there is no then permit to put the well, right, to draw water from that?
Correct, that's the Dehennis well.
Walk me through this as to how that works. Under your scenario, then, the authority has to file a TIA. Now, what's the TIA going to say? There's been a taking, correct?
Yes, I think you have to step back and first say that there's a TIA for the well permitting rules before you get to the actual permit application.
Okay, well, let's just talk about the individual permit application.
Okay.
What you're going to end up with here is a takings claim. Even though the statute says that because there's no historical use, the authority had no discretion to grant that permit.
Well, I think that's an interesting question, and I think that one of the answer for the EAA is to grandfather the wells that were drilled before June 28, 1996, which is when this court decided Barshop. Because, for instance,
but that's entirely contrary to the express language of the statute.
Yeah,
no, it's not.
Well, we're heading for a takings claim here. I mean, let's say you get the TIA and you end up with a takings claim. Take me where that goes. Then the authority is now liable to pay the property owner for the property that's taken.
Okay. On the takings claim, let me say one thing before addressing the takings claim. They did grandfather other wells. There's no debate about that. It's in the preamble to their rules. It's because of this unique situation where you have a statute on the books, but no agency.
I mean, everybody could say that. Every single person who ever applies for a well permit who doesn't apply for the historical use can say, you can grandfather me.
Well, it goes up through the date that this court decided Barshop. But that's what they did with subdivision developers. But, okay, putting all that aside,
I want to see where the takings claim leads us.
Okay. What is it that you want me to address about
the
takings
claim?
Well,
then the authority is now responsible to compensate the landowner.
Yes, and an important part of this is in the Edwards Aquifer Act, in Section 1.07 of the Edwards Aquifer Act, they say three things in that act. They say, we are expressly recognizing property rights in groundwater. We're recognizing that the landowner has ownership rights in that water. That's the first point.
Well, now, I understand you're telling me that the Act allows that, but I mean, what you end up with is the authority paying takings claims.
Well, that's exactly what the legislature says in 1.07.
Okay. What is the subsidence district to do with 5,000 permits?
You know, I've heard about this reference to the subsidence district's brief, and I haven't gotten it, so I'm at a loss to...
Well, presume with me that the subsidence district has 5,000 permits.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen to the day-to-day operations if this is the scenario we're going to end up with? TIAs and then property takings claims and payment to landowners.
Two important points here. The first one is, if you do a good TIA on your permitting rules, you should be able to address in broad programmatic fashion certain categories of problems so that you won't have those takings claims. Second, if governmental regulation does in fact take private property, the legislature has clearly spoken and said, we want property owners to be compensated. We don't want individual people to be singled out to bear the cost of regulating the Edwards. We want the public at large to pay for it. That's what the legislature has said. The Constitution obviously addresses that, but because there are problems with constitutional taking claim, the legislature went beyond that and said, this is very important to us. But I want to emphasize here that this case is not about the court awarding the Braggs water. It's not about the court awarding the Braggs damages. It's just about telling the EAA that they have to comply with the Property Rights Act and take property rights into account when they're passing their administrative rules.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. I think both sides got at least the 20 minutes we allotted, and the court will now take a brief recess.